the headlines. Iran says it is ready to resume talks on the 2015 nuclear deal, but is doubtful about the seriousness of the U.S. to return to the JCPOA. Pakistan's prime minister accuses India of a, quote, reign of terror on Muslims, drawing a harsh criticism from New Delhi. Also in the headlines, two Canadians imprisoned in China are released after Huawei's chief financial officer held in Canada on U.S. fraud charges was freed. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is Muniz. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to resume talks on the 2015 nuclear deal, but is doubtful about the seriousness of the U.S. to return to the accord. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment while meeting with his French counterpart, Jean-Yves Le Drian, on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly. Amir Abdullahian noted that the U.S. has not taken a serious and practical step to resume compliance with the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Said that Tehran is rapidly reviewing the minutes of the talks held in Vienna with JCPOA parties since April in order to restart negotiations. The top diplomat stressed that Iran wants to see tangible results from any talks aimed at reviving the pact that Washington unilaterally left 3 years ago. Le Drian, for his part, said that Paris is worried about delays in the continuation of the Vienna talks and wants them to resume as soon as possible. India and Pakistan have traded jabs at the annual session of the UN General Assembly, accusing each other of harboring extremists. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan accused his Indian counterpart Narendra Modi of, quote, a reign of terror on Muslims and planning to purge India of them. Khan said the worst form of Islamophobia now rules India. Comments came as India has witnessed a number of anti-Muslim riots perpetrated by the ruling party allied extremist Hindu outfits. Modi has also rescinded the statehood of the disputed Muslim-majority region of Kashmir and pushed through a citizenship law that critics call discriminatory against Muslims. Meanwhile, the first secretary at India's UN mission accused Pakistan of sheltering al-Qaeda mastermind Osama bin Laden, who was killed back in 2011. She also accused Pakistan of nurturing terrorists. Tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are facing a barrage of detention and vicious expulsion campaigns since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government, which calls them a security threat. Data by Indian Crime Records Agency shows that Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Munawar Zaman has the details.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threats to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy, regardless of the geostrategic interest. and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Muslim pilgrims are marching toward Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arbaeen. Pilgrims are arriving in the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arbaeen falls on September 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. It has allowed only 40,000 foreign visitors into the country, many of them Iranians. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with the tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Two Canadians detained in China on spying charges are released after Ottawa freed a top executive of Chinese communications giant Huawei, held in the country on U.S. fraud charges. The release of Huawei's Meng Wanzhou came after a deal with U.S. prosecutors to end a case against her. Meng had been fighting against extradition to the U.S. since she was arrested in Vancouver nearly 3 years ago. She was charged with misleading HSBC Bank on Huawei's dealings with Iran. Both Meng and the Chinese telecom giant dismissed the allegations. Meanwhile, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced two Canadians imprisoned in China were freed and are heading home. The events have brought an abrupt end to legal and geopolitical wrangling that for the past 3 years roiled relations between Washington, Beijing, and Ottawa. Zamir Ahmad Awan is a sinologist and former Pakistan ambassador to China who joins us from Islamabad. So tell us, in your opinion, what led to this breakthrough? Because obviously it was 3 years that this was going on. What happened here?
It is a very good move. In fact, Canada and China were having a tension in the diplomatic relation for last 3 years. Both of them were blaming each other. So now with the release of these political prisoners, will relieve them. And the relation between the two countries will improve. In fact, Meng was violating there was allegation on the Meng, the violation of laws in America, and she was arrested in Canada. That was really unacceptable for the Chinese. Anyhow, with the release of Meng and the two Canadians in Beijing, the relationship will improve immensely, and it is a good example for the rest of the world if they wanted to follow by settling down their disputes with the diplomatic and political basis through dialogue. We welcome this move.
Yeah, but you know, they were held in imprisonment, for example, for 3 years, the two Canadians in China. There were many, obviously, viewpoints on this. The one pivotal one being that this was U.S.'s way of getting at China, or getting to China, not only during the time that the former President Trump was in power, but also now Biden with this offensive against China. Did that have anything to do with the Chinese lady who was imprisoned? Was it a result of that?
In fact, China and America are rivals. And America think that the rise of China is a threat to America. So they are always trying to resist the Chinese rise. They are trying to put diplomatic, political, and economic pressure on China. Of course, this is in that series. It is impact of that rivalry. The release of Ms. Meng from the Canadian prison is appreciated, and it will improve the relation between Canada and China. But however, the overall relation between America and China are still, there are many, many differences and many, many issues to be overcome. We hope American has shown some flexibility in case of Ms. Meng, and they should show more flexibility on other issues to improve the relation between America and the China.
Thank you very much for that, Zami Ahmad Awan there from Islamabad. Many thanks for your comments. Moving on, the U.S. President Joe Biden has intensified his efforts to make pacts with Asia-Pacific countries in the face of a rising China. Biden sat down with the leaders of Australia, India, and Japan in the first in-person summit at the White House, where they agreed for a stable and democratic Indo-Pacific. The leaders of the Quad group discussed regional challenges in a veiled dig at rival China, although it was not mentioned. They called the group a practical initiative to confront pressures and challenges. U.S. officials later stressed that the group is not a military alliance. China was quick to react, saying that the bloc is doomed to fail. The Quad meeting marked another U.S. step in reviving its focus on diplomatic efforts after its recent controversial security pact with Australia. That move was also immediately denounced by China and France. Britain is experiencing long queues outside of fuel stations, including in the capital, after a shortage of truck drivers forced temporary closure of many retail stations. Consumers were seen waiting in their vehicles in London and several counties, including Kent and Surrey, for hours. The panic came after British Petroleum closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's office has said it is looking at temporary measures to address the shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association says that the country currently needs nearly 90,000 truck drivers to meet the demand. The driver shortage is said to have been partly caused by Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic. The EU fails in its efforts to combat corruption at the highest levels in Ukraine. The European Court of Auditors report includes billions of euros have been squandered in the country. Jerm Hughes has more from Brussels.
For the past 20 years now, the European Union has been pumping billions of euro into Ukraine. The master plan, according to analysts, is to create a big ally right next to Russia. The problem is Ukraine is still corrupt to the core, according to a new report from the EU's financial watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, or ECA. We spoke online to one of the authors.
The Commission should rethink the strategy, more focused on the root causes of these corruption. And we say the grand corruption.
Since 2014 alone, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission. Corruption reform efforts funded by the EU have failed, the European Court of Auditors report finds. Critics say the EU uses Ukraine as a pawn to provoke Russia. On the issue of energy alone, it appears Moscow would be of greater benefit to the EU.
When you look at this scathing report, does it make you think that perhaps you've picked the wrong side in all of this?
It is not vis-a-vis one or the other country that Ukraine is a strategic partner. Ukraine is an important country in its own right.
The European Court of Auditors report states the EU has long been aware of the connection between oligarchs, high-level officials, politicians, the judiciary, and state-owned enterprises. However, the 27-nation bloc has failed to tackle this with its cash injections. Experts say gangsters are running Ukraine.
We see that they have their people and their ideas, which is much more serious, all over the place, in the parliament, in the government.
The EU's executive arm insists progress has been made in the fight against corruption in the country, despite what the ECA report says. The European Commission's defence of Ukraine simply could not have been more robust. There's little to no doubt taxpayers will view that as scandalous. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An Italian court has ordered the ex-president of Spain's Catalonia region to be freed following his arrest in Sardinia. Carles Puigdemont must remain on the Italian island while an extradition request from Spain is considered. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
Former Catalan regional leader Carles Puigdemont must stay in Sardinia, Sassari judge ruled on Friday. The politician had been arrested by the Italian police upon his arrival to the Sardinian town of Alghero on Thursday night. Puigdemont had reportedly travelled there to attend a conference, but he was put in custody as soon as he stepped onto Italian soil. He was detained under an international arrest warrant issued by Spain over his alleged involvement in the unilateral independence referendum and the subsequent unilateral declaration of independence of Catalonia 4 years ago.
From the very beginning, the Catalan government and myself, we contacted all the authorities at the European level, at the European Union level, also authorities from Italy and here in Sardinia. We are very, very thankful about all the support that we received from El Síndic de l'Alguer and the community here.
Puigdemont is now a member of the European Parliament living in Belgium. Tens of supporters of the politician demonstrated outside the Sassari court calling for his release.
Later on Friday, former Catalonia president Puigdemont was released by a local court, but the politician will have to remain in Sardinia until questions such the validity of the European arrest warrant against him and his immunity status are resolved. Should the arrest be considered valid, the same court will have to decide whether to hand him over to the Spanish authorities.
Should Puigdemont be extradited to Spain, the climate among the independentists would very much heat up. Mass protests would be staged in Madrid outside the courts. Personally, I think the Italian judges will not extradite him. Having said it, it's also a political decision, and Italy has no interest in meddling in Spain's internal politics.
Italy's justice ministry on its side has made clear it had played no role in the case, which, quote, was the sole preserve of the judges involved. Max Civili, Rome.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his team have failed to make meaningful progress when it comes to striking the desperately coveted bilateral trade deal with the United States, which he and other prominent Brexiteers assured the country would be straightforward. We now present you an article written by John White, an author and political commentator based in Scotland. The piece is titled, Brexit is propelling Britain towards the door marked failed state. Energy crisis, empty supermarket shelves, labour shortages, widespread and deepening poverty. increasingly poor relations with neighbouring countries, failure to achieve bilateral trade deals, moral panic over refugees and migrants in general. No, this isn't the plight of a country in the global south lacking the benefits of a developed economy. This is the United Kingdom today. When Boris Johnson succeeded in replacing Theresa May as the country's leader in 2019, in his first speech to the House of Commons, he set out a vision of Brexit Britain, so utopian you could have lapsed into believing the country was on the cusp of a new golden age. Boris Johnson even used the term golden age in his speech, declaring that we will look back on this period, this extraordinary period, as the beginning of a new golden age for our United Kingdom. The extent to which Boris Johnson's bombast was divorced from reality is measured, just over 2 years later, in growing shortages of certain foods, due to the interruption of frictionless trade with the rest of Europe, with some experts predicting the shortages will only get worse once the full regulatory and customs agreements of Brexit come into force by next summer. The price of not only luxury items, but even basic items such as milk, eggs and vegetables will rise in consequence. What with retailers guaranteed to pass on at least some of their increased costs in bureaucracy to import items from Europe and beyond. Meanwhile, the shortage of truck drivers due to Brexit, due to EU nationals no longer being able to work and live in the United Kingdom, has reached 100,000 compared to pre-pandemic numbers. This has led to severe transportation delays with more shortages of everything from auto parts to furniture and construction materials, the result. The energy crisis that has engulfed the United Kingdom, resulting in many energy companies going bust and the energy bills of hundreds of thousands of households going up exponentially, has a global dimension, in that countries such as China and India have increased their demand for natural gas as their economies have begun to bounce back after the worst of the pandemic. There is also the fact that Russia refuses to increase production from the agreed level per its state energy company Gazprom's existing contract with the United Kingdom and other European markets. Perhaps in hindsight, it wasn't the best idea to embrace the role of America's Trojan horse in Europe when it came to supporting sanctions against Moscow and saber-rattling over Crimea and Ukraine. This escalating energy crisis has been made worse in Britain because of the unconscionable decision of Boris Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, to allow the closure of the country's then largest gas storage facility in 2017, thus significantly lowering the level of gas reserves the United Kingdom can store at any given time. However, the main thing this crisis reveals is that for-profit energy supply system has been a disaster for consumers in Britain since it was introduced in the 1980s. The threat of Belfast Good Friday Agreement threatens peace in Ireland. What with the loyalist and unionist community up in arms over the border down the Irish Sea that Boris Johnson and his acolytes have pledged would not be established, bringing the UK-controlled six counties in Northern Ireland into the EU's trading and customs orbit in order to ensure that a hard border is not reintroduced between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. As these words are being written, Boris Johnson is in Washington meeting his US counterpart, Joe Biden, who has made clear his concerns about the danger Brexit poses to peace in Ireland. At the same time, Boris Johnson and his team have failed to make meaningful progress when it comes to striking the desperately coveted bilateral trade deal with the United States, which he and other prominent Brexiteers assured the nation would be straightforward. Finally, turning to foreign policy, the recent formation of a US-UK-Australia military pact known as AUKUS is a prime example of looking to the last century for the answers to the challenges and issues of the one we happen to be living in. It is clear that, formed with China in mind, AUKUS is a desperate and futile attempt to counter China's growing assertion of global leadership. This leadership is more than deserved. Beijing's stunning Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, is a transformational infrastructure and investment project that has successfully forged partnerships with governments all over the world. Meanwhile, the development model long preferred in Western capitals, that is, establishing clients and satellites across the world at the end of bayonets with exploitation, not partnership in mind, is in steep decline, unsurprisingly, so given the instability and mayhem it has sown. London's participation in the AUKUS military pact is yet another act of desperation as it attempts to maintain relevancy and clout on the world stage post-Brexit. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian accurately described Britain's role in this new formation as opportunistic, and France has withdrawn from scheduled talks on defence with Britain in protest at what it views as a duplicitous attempt to undermine NATO. As for China, it has accused the powers involved of being in possession of an outdated Cold War zero-sum mentality. More prosaically, a few short wigs after a humiliating and panicked departure from Afghanistan might not be the best time to be talking out about the prospects of talking to China. So now this is where the United Kingdom finds itself, crisis-ridden at home and increasingly irrelevant abroad. Having made the mistake of getting drunk on British obscurantism, British society has woken up with a hangover. Brexit, the result of this bacchanalia of nationalism and nostalgia for empire, is the equivalent of a man walking backwards with his face to the future. As the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly gets underway in New York, Brexit has propelled the United Kingdom not towards the new golden age promised by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but instead towards the door-marked failed state.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesti. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says Iran is ready to resume talks on restoring the 2015 nuclear deal very soon. However, he says U.S. is sending a negative signal by keeping and even intensifying sanctions on Iran. In an interview with U.S. media, Amir Abdollahian said Washington has taken no action to prove its readiness to return to the deal. He said the existing U.S. approach contradicts President Joe Biden's criticism of its predecessor's policy toward Iran. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal back in 2018 and reimposed crippling sanctions on Iran. Tehran, still adhering to the deal, began reducing its nuclear deal-related commitments a year later. Since the Biden administration took office, Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held six rounds of talks in Vienna in an effort to revive the accord. For more on that, we're now joined by our correspondent, Homa Lesgius, with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, Bhavya, that's right. So six rounds of negotiations have been held, of course, under the previous administration of Hassan Rouhani. And now it seems that we're going to have a resumption of these talks. We don't know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. Of course, we're expecting a new team from the Iranian side. But of course, I guess the fundamental policies that have been pursued by the Iranian side are not changing when it comes to the demands that Iran is making in these talks. We also heard the U.S. President Biden at the U.N. General Assembly saying that the United States is also prepared to return to full compliance. But the key question here is, what is full compliance as far as Iran is concerned and as far as the U.S. is concerned? Those are questions that, of course, have been raised time and time again during the Vienna talks. For instance, Iran saying that it wants all of the U.S. sanctions, both the JCPOA-related ones and also the additional sanctions imposed under the Trump administration, to be fully removed. And at the same time, it wants to verify their removal before it returns to full compliance. This was seen as a sticking point in the talks. Another issue, of course, has been what sanctions the U.S. is prepared to lift. Apparently, the U.S. was not willing to lift all of the sanctions that Iran was asking for, and also Iran calling for guarantees that the JCPOA will indeed remain alive and there won't be another decision by this or another U.S. administration, for instance, to withdraw from it and to simply violate it. So we'll have to see, of course. The readiness has been expressed by all sides that they want these talks to resume. And, of course, everyone has expressed hope that they hope that these continuation of these talks will lead to the revival of the deal. But, of course, it has been a very complicated process.
All right. Thanks, Homa Lesgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Joining us, though, on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. And also we have journalist and author Daniel Azar, who's with us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. It's great to have you with us here on Press TV Spotlight. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that Iran is ready to resume talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, but the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sending, quote-unquote, negative signals and a negative sign by keeping illegal sanctions on Tehran. In your opinion, why is the U.S. Keeping those sanctions in place?
Well, we've mentioned this before in earlier discussions on the topic, and that is because there's a very, very powerful Israel lobby in the United States, which has incredible power over both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And there are costs to pay if you make moves against the Israel lobby in U.S. politics. So Biden has not yet arranged permission, in effect, from Israel to take action on this topic. And that's the crux of the problem, although most people don't want to talk about that in the United States.
Let's cross over to Daniel Lazar in New York. It's great to have you with us here on the program. Mr. Lazar, the top Iranian diplomat, he said that Biden needed to take back, or rather needed to back up, excuse me, his talk of diplomacy with concrete actions to show Iran that Washington is serious about restoring the nuclear deal. Is Washington serious, in your opinion, or does it have ulterior motives regarding the revival of the deal?
I don't think it is serious, no. I think that it wants to revise the deal, take into account a whole range of non-nuclear activities by Iran, which is clearly beyond the scope, beyond the logic of the 2015 nuclear accord. So I think that that essentially is going to kill any hope of reviving the deal. Your previous guest is correct that the Israeli lobby, pro-Israel lobby, is a major force behind this kind of thinking. But equally important are the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. The U.S. has constructed an entire defense network based on reigning in Iran, and Biden is not willing to alter that in any significant way. In fact, he wants to tighten the circle around Iran and use a revived 2015 nuclear accord as a means of doing so.
So I have this question scheduled for later on, but as you brought it up, I'm going to address it to both of you right now. Mr. Bosnich, who benefits from this limbo, from this uncertainty of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, the military-industrial complex, because it allows them to lobby for further investment in so-called defensive measures against Iran. I mean, it's an absurdity on the face of it. Iran poses no military threat whatsoever to the United States, and Iran poses no military threat to anyone in the region. Iran is a strong country, has a large population, a well-educated population, and Iran has the right to defend itself. But who benefits from the limbo? The limbo benefits those who hate Iran, those who want to destroy the Iranian economy, who want to destabilize Iran, and to make Iran a non-player in its own region. Those are the persons and the states and the entities that are benefiting. And you are correct, your other guest is correct in saying that it is not only the Israel lobby, but there is a very strong lobby led largely by Saudi Arabia, which also wants to restrict the ability of Iran not just to develop its nuclear energy industry, but to restrict Iran's ability to exist as a stable economy.
Daniel Lazar, same question to you.
Well, I mean, I think I agree. I would just add that that Iran, by allying itself with China and to a certain degree with Russia as well, that Iran now is kind of a frontline state. America is pressing its offensive against both Moscow and Beijing, and it sees Iran as being kind of a cat's paw for those two countries. So therefore, for a variety of reasons, U.S. hostility to Iran is extremely high. It's actually only increasing. So therefore, it wants to use, I said before, a revived version of the 2015 nuclear accord in order to put Iran even more on the defensive. So Iran, I mean, I can't imagine Iran ever saying yes to that. And if Biden were to drop his non-nuclear demands, there would be a storm in Washington among pro-Israel, pro-Saudi, pro-Gulf forces, as well as those who are most hostile to Russia and China, which essentially means 95% of the entire U.S. establishment.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Lazar. Iran announced that the new administration will resume talks in Vienna, but according to the foreign minister, the Raisi administration neither accepts the U.S.'s unconstructive behavior, nor will it forestall Iran's progress based on Washington's habitually empty promises. The survival of the deal now is basically on the line, given that Washington is the one that walked away from the international accord. It should be Washington that remedies what it has done first. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree. I mean, yes, of course, legally, there's no doubt about that. The U.S. is the one which broke the deal, and the U.S. therefore should be the one which apologizes for so doing so and enters back into the deal with no other, you know, preconditions. But the U.S. is not going to do that. As I said before, the U.S. is now making a raft of non-nuclear demands, which it insists that Iran agreed to as a precondition for any revival of the 2015 nuclear accord. So that's why I think that the negotiations are stalled while they'll go nowhere. I've always argued the 2015 accord is essentially doomed.
Mr. Bosnich, shouldn't it be Washington demonstrating its seriousness in returning to the deal after President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. From the deal unilaterally, also coupled with Joe Biden's criticism of his predecessor's policy toward Iran?
Absolutely correct. There's no doubt about it that the initiative to destroy the deal, to block the deal, and to end the deal came from the United States, and the United States did not have grounds for making that move. But you have to remember that U.S. politics is very much a charade. The candidates say what they like during the election term. Whoever wins the election then pursues whatever policies he or she wants to pursue, because there's no accountability. There's no recall. There's no way to force the president to fulfill his promises. There's no way to hold Biden to what he said about the deal. In effect, what happens is every 4 years, the American public is lied to by two candidates who vary on some domestic policy lines, but on international politics, they follow the state line. And the state line is directly dictated to the president by the military-industrial complex that buys all the members of Congress via bribery. So you are not dealing here with a rational, logical progression. You are dealing here with a facade, with a charade politics. And the only way to respond to this is to stand firm and to seek support from other countries which have great power, such as Russia, such as China, and other independent countries around the world. There are still a few of them, and they need to speak out. And they should speak out not just in this forum, but they should also speak out at the United Nations.
Daniel Azar, a major question here is what assurances can be given that another administration doesn't just come along and leave the deal again like Donald Trump did? Basically, I'm asking, should the U.S. be trusted?
Well, I mean, first of all, number one, I assume the deal will not go through. I assume that Joe Biden will blame it on Iran. And, of course, he'll declare America as guiltless, and America, by definition, is always guiltless. But I think that if by some miracle Joe Biden did go through with the deal, did re-enter the deal, if by some absolute miracle negotiations in Vienna were successful, then yes, I think there's a very good chance that if the Republicans come back into office in 2024, the first thing they will do will be to abandon this deal.
Mr. Bosnich, would you like to weigh in on that for us, please?
Well, I fully agree, and I think that any deal that's ever signed with the United States of America as it stands now needs to be secured by severe penalty clauses. And those penalty clauses have to be in the language that they understand, and they only understand one language, and that is the language of money. Immense financial penalties for violating the deal. And those financial penalties need to be paid into a third party that's independent, and the monies must flow to Iran to not just punish the violator of the deal, but to also compensate Iran for the immense losses caused by the sanctions. And I can say that those must be adding up into the hundreds of billions of dollars already, and I think that that would cause some pain in Washington if such money had to be deposited in a neutral third party before any deal would take effect. They only understand money. Mammon is their god, and you have to speak to him in those terms.
Daniel Azar, Iran's foreign minister, has echoed a comment brought up many times before. The reality of the matter is that for years, this is, of course, the comments of the foreign minister, the reality of the matter is that for years, we have not obtained any benefits from the JCPOA. So the question is, why has Iran shouldered the responsibility of keeping the JCPOA afloat without gaining anything from it?
That's a good question, actually. I think that Iran has little to lose at this point by going along with the Vienna negotiations. I mean, it knows that the negotiations are a farce. It has every reason to believe they will go nowhere. But it has, I think it's rational for Iran to sort of string the U.S. along, to go along with this process, and to make a good faith effort to see these negotiations through to conclusion, even though it knows that that's extraordinarily unlikely. Because I think not to do so would give a huge advantage to the U.S. It would allow the U.S. to portray Iran as being recalcitrant, being unwilling to talk, being essentially beyond the pale, and therefore would justify offensive military actions by the U.S. and Israel. So I think that Iran is correct to go to sort of, you know, follow through on this diplomatic process, even though it knows that it's likely not to lead to anything good.
And Mr. Bozic, same issue I'd like you to address as well. Iran has basically been, I think in real terms, has been the only country that has been adhering to the JCPOA, but it has been gaining nothing from it during this time.
Well, you know, these are the facts of life on this planet today. We live in a world which is largely controlled by the United States and its colonial hold over other nations. You'll notice that the European powers that are supposed to be assisting in resolving this deal actually have no say in Washington. They can negotiate with Iran, they can come up with whatever solutions they like, but until they start to behave like independent states, nothing will happen. So what we're really dealing with here is the imperial empire structure of U.S. control of this world. And I do agree with your other guest that Iran must continue in good faith. Iran must do everything it can to demonstrate to the public of the world what kind of an adversary Iran faces. And I think it's very important that you here on Press TV discuss it, and that your representative at all talks speak to the media openly and explain what happens behind closed doors, because even the American people would never believe the way their own government treats other countries. That information needs to be shared. And then perhaps you can apply some pressure on the United States, both internally and internationally. Stay the course, be clear, state your rights, defend them, and hope that there are still a few honest people in Washington who will open their mouths and say that this is unfair.
Mr. Lazar, how would you rate Europe's performance regarding the JCPOA? For example, their commitments, their stance on the U.S. abruptly leaving the deal. Have the Europeans held up their end in all of this?
No, quite the contrary. They have failed to uphold their responsibilities by upholding the pact against U.S. attacks. This has been the most shocking development, you know, thing that's happened since 2015. Germany, France, they have not gone along at all. They have not defended the integrity of the Vienna process. And the Europeans, have learned, you know, where things lie, thanks to Biden's nuclear deal with Australia, which is a dramatic rebuff, stab in the back to France. So the U.S. treats its European allies with contempt, yet these same allies are afraid to essentially buck U.S. authority in any way. And Iran has been a primary victim of that European cowardice.
John Bozic, last question to you. How would you rate Europe's performance when you look at the JCPOA?
Zero. I'm sorry to say it, but France is here, as your other guest just mentioned. France has itself just been stabbed in the back, and its inaction is demonstrating that France is not a world power. Germany's inaction is demonstrating that Germany is not a world power and that they are just as much a colonial asset of the United States as they were years ago. This is a bad indication of the way the world is going, and I think that Iran is doing the best that it can and the best that anybody could under the circumstances, and I have to praise you for your patience. I must say that you need to stand by your position. It's the legal and correct position, and you need to recruit support from other countries that have received the hard end of the stick from America, because Iran is not alone. You are being targeted now, but you are just one of the many countries that has suffered this kind of treatment by the U.S. empire.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for its show. Thanks to journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Also thanks to journalist and author Daniel Lazar, speaking to us from New York. And allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to touch and talk about some, let's say, questions or misunderstandings which are being asked by different questioners about the theological issues and any questions regarding the religious concepts. For this, we invite Islamic researchers and scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. That's why we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to join us in this studio and help us with answer. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. The question of the day that we need to ask it now from a respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is concerning a question which is usually being asked from the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, from the Shias, that why you people try to mourn or cry over the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. If you believe that shahada or martyrdom paves the way for a person to enter paradise or Jannah, then don't you think that he attains happiness and prosperity in both worlds? So for a person who's going to be happy and prosperous, so what does it mean that you start crying and, let's say, mourning for him ages and ages? Don't you think that you need to correct this action and attitude of yours? So this question is usually being asked from the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, and we need to ask Sheikh Murtada to shed some light on this issue to see what is the philosophy of these cryings and mournings. If really we believe that martyrdom is prosperity, so why should we cry? Why should we mourn over him? We should be happy and show our happiness. This is what is being asked, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Usually this question is asked by the Wahhabis, and we see that Ibn Taymiyyah, the forefather of this school of thought, maybe he is the first one who has mentioned that. In one of his books, the famous book Minhaj al-Sunnah al-Nabawiyyah, volume 1, page 52, he says that he talks about the Shia, and he says that وَمِنْ حِمَاقَتِهِمْ إِقَامَةُ الْمَأْتَمْ وَالنِّيَاحَ عَلَى مَنْ قَدْ قُتِلَ مِنْ سَنِينْ عَدِيدًا. One of the foolish actions of the Shia is that they hold sessions, mourning ceremonies for a person who was killed many years ago. In another place, he says that one of the bid'ah innovations of the Shia is bid'atul huzn wal buka wal nawh yawm Ashura. The fact that they mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the day of Ashura. Now, the question, as you mentioned, reads that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, according to the Shia, is in paradise. Of course, in the paradise which is related to the world of Barzakh. And he is happy, so why do you mourn? There are different aspects to this question. First of all, I mean, there are different philosophies for why Shia mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. We believe that one of the reasons for this mourning ceremony is that we remember Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the philosophy of his uprising, which was the uprising of the oppressed people against the oppressive rulers. And that is why we see that during the history of Shia, maybe in most of the cases they were inspired by Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to rise against the oppression and the oppressive rulers of the time. Nowadays we see in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran in 1979, all these revolutions, all these uprising against the oppressive rulers, they are inspired by the revolution of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And this is one of the philosophies for crying. And then the second point is that it is also a matter of emotion. I think I mentioned in one of the previous episodes that if, for example, our father passes away, we will mourn for him maybe a couple of days. Yeah. Now, imagine that he is a very righteous person. So for that, we may mourn for him more because he has been, let's say, the most righteous person in our city. Now, imagine that he did not die a natural death, rather he was brutally killed. Then we will, the children will mourn for him more.
But it is said that you will cry for him for 1 year, 2 year, not for 14th century. This is the question that this person actually wants to make it out here.
I'm talking about the emotions to show that it's also a matter of emotion. And then we can add that not only our father has been brutally killed, but also, a great number of our family members. Again, we'll cry for him and for them more and more. And we can add that the family members have been imprisoned and so on and so forth. So for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, we have all of them, and the most righteous person on the earth was martyred by those people. So it's a matter of emotion too.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Inshallah.